and welcome to another exciting installment of Literary Loitering, the geek show's dedicated show to all things books and arts / books and arts tangentially related. I'm Andrew, and I'm joined by my co-host, Rob.
Hello.
I don't know why I called you A. Rob.
Except,
I mean, I guess that is factually correct.
I am A. Rob. I'm not an Arab, though.
Once again, Graham is not with us, and so we have completely fallen apart.
I know.
He is the glue that holds this show together, by which I mean he is the one who does all the planning, and without him we've had to do it, and we're not good at it, Rob. We're not good at it.
This is true. This is very, very true. But we did manage to find some things for us to talk about today.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. Starting off,
I mean, I thought I was up for just an hour of uncomfortable silence, but I guess we can talk.
Well, that would be like the best art house podcast, though, wouldn't it?
God, we could totally get away with it.
I know.
Just as an art piece, release a completely silent podcast.
Just an hour of it wouldn't be completely silent. You've got to have like shades of breathing and maybe the odd kind of grunt.
Exactly, it's the sounds of life.
Maybe the slap slap sound of a clown flipping a pancake.
I'm sorry, what?
Do you not remember that sketch? I think it's from Simpsons or Family Guy, where they talk about art house and it's just a black and white thing of a clown flipping a pancake slowly.
No, but I'm just glad that it's Rob making an obscure reference again. Not Rob. This time he might actually have just finally gone.
I thought everyone knew that reference. Anyway. John le Carré, a letter that's come to light that he wrote in 2010 to a friend of his in America, which has shown his clear contempt and complete disdain for British politicians. He pours scorn on Tories, the Lib Dems, Labour, everybody. It's handwritten to an obstetrician from Maine, and it was written in August 2010 after the Conservative Party had failed to win a majority in the general election. Le Carré basically says, "The Etonians have taken back the shop with the help of some B-list inexperienced liberals who will evaporate in their own hot air before long, leaving the shop to a ragbag of Ivy League Tories, born-again PR men, sexists, anti-Europeans, nostalgists, and eco-ostriches."
Okay, so two things.
Yeah.
Firstly, damn John le Carré, that is very accurate.
I know.
You definitely called it. Second of all, park the brakes there, eco-ostriches.
Yep.
And I have scrolled down to that bit in the story. That's exactly what it says. Eco-ostrich.
Yep.
What does it mean?
I kind of get what it means.
Oh, wait, no, it's because they bury their head in the sand about the economy.
Yep.
Oh, that's just a clever metaphor. You know that John le Carré, he should be like a writer or something.
I know. The thing is, it doesn't spare the Labour Party either. He describes the Labour Party as a wastrel government that was for the people, by the people, except it was run by one bad Scottish piglet, talking about Tony Blair, and one unhappy Scottish hog, talking about Gordon Brown, who emptied the piggy bank for the people while they were about it.
I mean, I've started to think maybe he has a way with words.
See, the thing is, I just want this letter framed and put in the Houses of Parliament so every MP has to walk by it and look at it.
Possibly next to a statue of just John le Carré staring disapprovingly.
Yes. It's magnificent.
Also, excellent use of the word wastrel.
Yes. Is it wastrel or wastrel?
I think it's wastrel.
See, I've always pronounced it wastrel.
Yeah, this is probably why we are not, like, incredibly successful spy thriller writers.
Yeah, you're right. It is wastrel. Because it's taken from the word waste.
Oh. In which case, this is probably why you aren't an incredibly successful spy thriller writer.
I've always pronounced it wastrel because it doesn't have an E after the T. And I don't pronounce water as waiter.
I see the mistake you've made there, Rob.
Is the mistake in assuming the English language is something logical that can be understood?
That is 100% the mistake.
Yes. Oh, and here's a good bit as well from this letter. He ends with the condemnation of the late writer Christopher Hitchens, whom le Carré describes as a truly odious little twerp, or what our teachers used to call LMF, low moral fibre, or shit.
Oh, right, apparently Hitchens has been a vocal supporter of the Iraq War.
Yes.
I thought it was weird that he just ended it with a random burn on some author.
Yeah, he goes on to say, America has entered one of its periods of historical madness, but this is the worst I can remember. Worse than McCarthyism, worse than the Bay of Pigs, and in the long term potentially more disastrous than the Vietnam War.
See, now that bit...
Was that Hitchens who wrote that?
In, like, the wake of a post-Trump America.
Yeah.
That just seems lovely and naive.
Mm. I really want to read a John le Carré novel now.
Oh no, have you not read a John le Carré novel?
No, I've read a couple before. I just want to read one now. After reading this, I feel like if this is the kind of level of language and insult that he's capable of, maybe I should find a novel like that from John le Carré. And if he hasn't written one like that, why not?
Is John le Carré dead? John le Carré. Oh, no. Apparently he is still alive.
Yes.
And this story seems a bit weird then.
Well, I think it's because he's 86 now and he doesn't care.
I like the idea that John le Carré is just retired somewhere doing his own thing.
See, the interesting thing about this is partway down the article, just on the left-hand side, there is a secondary article that you can read called From Cold War Spy to Angry Old Man, The Politics of John le Carré.
I mean, I would read that book.
I would read that book as well. From politics, technically, to political incorrectness.
Yeah, that works.
How do I explain this? Apparently, 1 in 4 parents admit to altering parts of traditional fairy tales and children's stories when reading it to their children due to the fear it's either inappropriate or too scary. This includes stories that are purposefully designed for children.
Yeah, but I mean, if you like read some of the versions of Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah, but why...
Pretty sure in the original, like, the wolf just eats her.
Yeah, but why are you reading that version to your kids? The more accepted version is the version that we all know.
I mean, in their defense, but there's, like, a lot of versions. It's hard to tell.
I mean, the version of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, that, you know, that really dark version, yeah, you don't want to know that one. You don't tell your kids that one. You tell them the Disney version.
Especially if you get them off the internet.
Yeah, you tell them the Disney version.
And then Little Red Riding Hood said, oh, my grandma, what a big...
Yes.
Oh, no.
Cinderella, Goldilocks, you tell them the Disney versions. Disney-fy them.
I mean, I probably don't. I actually maybe do this. Because those Disney versions are kind of sexist.
Yeah. But then again, the fairy tales themselves are kind of sexist as well.
Yeah, possibly because they were written in like the 1600s and now don't reflect the gender roles of modern society.
Yeah, I mean, a gender-neutral Snow White? That'd be a thing to see.
I mean, I'm just thinking more, maybe not make every single female character completely dependent on a prince to save them.
Well, they're doing that now. I mean, we've got our own modern fairy tales these days, haven't we? I mean, Disney Pixar coming up with all sorts of interesting stuff. I mean, Mulan, for example, is definitely not a princess who was waiting for someone to save her.
Yes, Mulan, the very modern Disney fairy tale.
Saying that, yeah, okay, it's based on Mulan from Chinese folklore, but Disney went on to do things like Brave and stuff like that, Moana. Female characters who don't wait for the man to save them. Frozen. That's the big one, isn't it?
It is. As someone who has never seen Frozen, I can only shrug and say, yep, that is a thing I've heard.
You might not have seen Frozen, but you're aware of just how long it ran for, though, and how big indentation in parents' wallets it made.
I'm also very familiar with the fact that the song Do You Want to Build a Snowman is incredibly similar to the song that Barbra Streisand sings in Yentl. Because that was in Deadpool 2. And they say I'm not cultured.
I forgot about that bit. Wow. According to Liam Howley, the marketing director at Music Magpie, which has commissioned this research, some of these stories have been around for generations and many would have been read to mums and dads when they were kids. But times have changed, and there are many elements in classic tales which for some don't really fit into society as they once did, which is a fair point. Not only that, but when you think about the storylines, some of them can be considered scary for little children. They're fitting into modern society, I can understand, but the scary for little kids?
Okay, counterpoint.
Yeah.
This article has reminded me of Jesus Christ the Pied Piper of Hamelin.
Yeah.
You know, that story what ends with him abducting all the children.
Yep.
Straight to his special cave.
See, that one, I will admit, the ending is genuinely terrifying.
Yeah, it is. But that being said, I think, yeah, this whole saying that the endings are too scary.
Yeah.
I think that's dumb.
Yeah.
Kids like creepy stuff.
Goosebumps was a massive series for kids, wasn't it?
Exactly. Goosebumps, Are You Afraid of the Dark, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and back when I was a kid, we had stuff like The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth. I mean, Labyrinth has some truly terrifying moments in that film. And The Dark Crystal, I'm sorry, but the Skeksis in that, which child wouldn't have nightmares if they met that in real life?
Oh my god, I've just found it on my bookshelf. not The Dark Crystal, but like my favourite book as a kid.
Oh?
It was like really messed up. Struhl Peter by Dr. Heinrich Hoffmann.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Okay, it's very kind of sort of Grimm's fairy tale-esque. There's lots of different fairy tale poems, but like basically all the kind of dark and messed up. Like there's the story of Cruel Frederick, who murdered animals and whipped people.
Oh.
And then he got mauled by a dog.
See, this is explaining your love of horror quite a lot, you know.
And then basically everyone shoved Cruel Frederick in a room and made him eat horrible medicine. And then petted the dog.
Yep, you're...
Oh, yeah, and the dreadful story about Harriet and the Matches, who set herself on fire. And then the final image is just her as a pile of ash. And oh no. Just found the story of the Inky Boys.
Okay.
Which, as an adult, I now realise, is super racist. But yeah, I think that brings me back around to the other point. Old-timey times were horrible, and sometimes we need to fix those stories.
Yeah, and I am not disputing that, as I said. But the horrific parts, sometimes there is a message in the horrific parts. That, yes, the Pied Piper... The Pied Piper, at the end of the story, he may have abducted all the children, but there was a reason why. The adults didn't stick to their word. He fixed their rat problem. And as soon as he fixed the rat problem, the adults basically went, oh, you can go take a hike, mate. We're not paying you.
Oh, yeah, there's always been an element of morality.
Mm. So I think...
But also, maybe the Three Bears should have just called the police on Goldilocks instead of resorting to vigilanteism.
Yes, yes. I'll agree with that. And, you know... But then again, Goldilocks shouldn't have been breaking and entering. I don't know, what does the modern law say about that? Saying about attacking somebody who breaks into your house to steal your stuff and eat your food and break your furniture?
I mean, that's basically what Goldilocks is about. It's about the fact that people should have the right to murder anyone who breaks into their property.
That is it, isn't it? I don't know if that could be used as a legal defence, though.
But officer, she ate all our porridge. Even this one that was far too hot, and this one that was far too cold.
And the baby bear just pipes up and says, she broke my chair.
Well, I mean, of course she did. She ate all that porridge. Yay! Surprise Game of Thrones watch.
Yes, surprise Game of Thrones watch. According to Digital Spy...
You're supposed to talk over this bit, Rob.
Am I? Okay. According to Digital Spy, this is everything that George R. R. Martin, or Guru Martin, is doing instead of writing The Winds of Winter.
This bit isn't really working, is it?
No, it's not. He blogs, right? He converses with fans on a near daily basis And he...
So is this just all the things George R. R. Martin is doing instead of writing Game of Thrones?
Yes, basically. He puts all his thoughts on not a blog and does that almost daily. He started a non-profit called the Stagecoach Foundation in 2017. And he has been visiting Westeros in different ways. He's been writing prequel stories, reference book called The World of Ice and Fire, fake histories for other anthologies, and is about to publish part one of Fire and Blood, which is coming later this year. He edits Wildcard compilations. He was games master for the role-playing game Superworld, and as an author, he wanted to explore and experience outside of the game itself, so he edits anthology novels from like more than 30 authors. He's busy telling HBO what happens in the story. He's developing more TV projects aside from Game of Thrones. He's working on an animated movie as well, based on his fantasy novel, The Ice Dragon.
George R. R. Martin, what are you doing?
He's doing everything but his job.
Just write the book. Don't write the prequel books for the series you haven't finished yet, George R. R. Martin.
Yep. Starting a non-profit. Okay, fine. That's great. Visiting Westeros in different ways. Yeah, great. Editing Wildcard compilations possibly could do without that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the stuff, it's cool that he's doing it, especially like the interacting with the fans and the blogging and stuff. Because yeah, that's always more fun when a creator is willing to engage with their readers.
Yep.
But also learn to prioritize, man.
Yeah. His werewolf novella, Skin Trade, which I covered the graphic novelization of on 4Panel ages ago, that was optioned by Cinemax in 2015. He's the executive producer of the HBO adaptation of the novel Who Fears Death, which was written by Nnedi Okorafor, and is involved with the proposed Universal Cable Productions TV show based on the Wildcard's novels, and is working with Sci-Fi and Netflix to turn his Nightflyers novel into a series.
This series is never going to get finished, is it?
No. Given all the other stuff he's doing instead of writing Winds of Winter, I don't reckon it's going to get finished.
So surely now there's going to be even more different series on TV where he's going to have to tell the producers how they end because he doesn't have time to write the books.
I don't know what to say about this.
Like, his entire job is just basically going to be telling people what would have happened in his book if he'd ever gotten around to writing it.
Is he going to be like that old man who tells like stories of his regrets? The one that got away?
Maybe that's what happened. Maybe George R. R. Martin one day accidentally shot a book out from the sky. And everyone on the boat thought it was bad luck. And so they made him tie it around his neck. And now all he's reduced to is sitting around lamenting.
Oh.
See, I can make literary references.
No, you can't. I never doubted it. All right, moving on. In 1829, a convict from Tasmania called William Swallow, he fled with a group of fellow prisoners. They seized the brig Cyprus and sailed it from Tasmania to China with stop-offs in New Zealand, Tonga, and Japan. Right, it's a story that's inspired a famous folk song, and it's now getting a modern transformation thanks to author and illustrator Simon Barnard. Now, this sounds like the kind of thing that maybe would make an interesting book, maybe even a movie or TV series, yeah?
Yep.
Well, it's not getting
especially
any...
Especially because it involves both Tasmania and Tonga.
Yeah. Tonga.
Tonga, that's what I mean.
Tasmania and Tonga, but it also has escaped convicts who steal a ship. And it's 1829, so it's not like it was a technologically advanced ship.
Also, William Swallow sounds like one of those ridiculous names that, like, a superhero has before they get their specific themed powers.
Either that or it's a pirate's name, isn't it? I mean, William Swallow sounds like a pirate.
Captain Swallow.
I didn't go that far with my thought.
Look, I'm going to have to finish it now, aren't I?
Yes.
This is Captain Swallow, the scourge of all seamen.
Oh,
not my fault, the joke was there. We're contractually obliged to say it.
Oh, that just made my day. Anyway, it's not getting any of those adaptations. What it is getting is a children's book.
Oh, no. This is definitely going to have to be the one where the parents change the ending.
And the title. Especially if it's your title. Simon Barnes produced the children's book Gallbird, which depicts William Swallow and the other characters from their hysterical heist as cartoon birds. And birds are long-standing...
Which, thank God, because as I've just proven, he shouldn't be a human being.
Yeah. Birds are a long-standing symbol of freedom, so Barnard has woven that the story in that way. Swallow represented himself. He changed his name to Swallow, which is a symbol of a safe return and a homecoming, and then escaped Van Diemen's Land. Van Diemen's Land?
Van Demon's Land.
Yes.
That's metal as hell.
I know. And the thing is, the way they spell demon is D-I-E-M-E-N.
So it's like Van Diemen's Land.
Yes.
That is rad.
Yep. Historian and curator of the National Maritime Museum, Dr. Stephen Gapps, who actually has an amazing mustache when you see the picture of him, has said that William Swallow's tale of escape is incredible. Amazing travels, it just blows your mind to think how they sailed from Tasmania to New Zealand over to the Pacific Islands to Japan and China.
Also, that is a fantastic mustache.
Yep.
It's like a really discreet handlebar mustache.
Yeah. But the thing is, when I'm looking at that picture, do you know what I'm thinking? Because he's wearing that hat and he's got that mustache and the way he's standing and looking at the camera, I am just thinking Bronson.
He does look a bit Bronson.
He does, doesn't he? And anyone who's confused by what we're talking about, Tom Hardy as Bronson. That's all you need to know. Just Google that. So, yeah, it might be interesting.
Yeah, sounds like a fun book for children at least.
Yeah, and the fact that they're told as birds actually makes sense. But anyway, this one caught me off guard. Romance novelists are basically, they've risen en masse to defend their right to use a particular word after one writer tried to trademark this particular adjective, right? The author who tried to trademark this particular adjective was Felina Hopkins, the self-published author of a series of books about six bad boy brothers that you'll apparently want to marry or hide under your bed.
No, Rob. I think, according to the official description, it's six bad boy brothers you'll want to marry or hide under you bed.
Yes, I know. I was being careful with the wording. So, yes, the word in question is the word cocky.
And this is a series of books about the Cocker brothers.
Yes, it is.
Oh, Felina.
And you have titles like Cocky Roomy, which is Jake Cocker, or Cocky Biker, which is Jet Cocker, or Cocky Cowboy, which is Jason Cocker.
Jet Cocker is my favourite Mega Man boss.
Cocky Romantic, Cocky Biker. Thing is, you can't trademark a word like cocky. It's like Facebook trying to trademark the word face.
Well, or it's... Remember that thing from a while ago where like the Fine Brothers tried to trademark the word react?
Yeah.
That's not how it works.
No. You can't trademark anything that's in common use because that would then forbid other people from using it, which, given the way language works, that's just...
Yeah, also, but, like, she didn't invent the word cocky.
No, she didn't.
In fact, I'm pretty sure she didn't even invent the idea of using the word cocky in the context of, ooh, sounds a bit like saucy bits.
Yeah. Because, after all, we have a town called Cock... Oh, God! We have a town called Cockermouth! All these brothers are called what?
The Cocker brothers. I mean, it's... I hate this because you can't even joke.
I know.
It's right there. Just you take off two letters and bam, there it is, right in your face. I was wrong, I can't make a joke about it.
Oh, the thing that I find odd about this is that this author is a self-published author trying to trademark the word cocky. Now, I could understand if it was somebody who had the weight of, like, a publishing company behind them trying to trademark it. But that's the same as you or me just walking into, you know, just sending a message to the patent office or wherever it is, saying, you know, we want to trademark this word.
Oh, my God. Apparently that she hasn't even... Well, she has trademarked it.
Hey.
Yeah, one of the other romance authors, Jamila Jasper, received a letter from her basically saying, yes, I have trademarked this word. Trademark registration number 5447836.
Really? Wow.
But, like, that's crazy. Surely it's got to be. Like, she has trademarked the idea that you can name a book Cocky Something.
I just want to write a bunch of stuff that has the title Cocky in it now and see what she does.
Because what resources does she have to take legal action? Like, surely if you're self-published, you're not even...
The thing is...
A legal precedent.
As disturbing as it is that she's trademarked the word cocky, I'm loving the hashtags.
Hashtag free cocky and hashtag cockygate.
Yeah. And
thank you, Internet. Thank you, Internet, for giving us this gift.
It's amazing, isn't it?
That's very good.
Oh, I don't think we need the Turkmenistan story. But we can do it anyway because it is, well, pardon the phrasing for shits and giggles, but it's kind of appropriate in this one.
It is. I'll allow it.
Turkmenistan police. This is technically a story about photography. Very technical, though. Turkmenistan police have begun inspecting public and private toilets across the country for evidence that photos of President Gurbanguly...
Yeah, no, please pronounce that last name, Rob.
Berdy Mukhamedov. Yes!
Damn. But anyway, Big Gerbs, as he's known to his friend.
Yes.
And that is friend singular.
Or the Gerb bird.
I like the Gerb bird.
Yes. For evidence that photos of President Gerb bird are being used as toilet paper.
That's...
Yeah.
That's just such a weird mixture of, like, fun whimsy and also horrible totalitarianism.
Yeah, but it's kind of horrible totalitarianism because the Turkmenistan president, it's the same country that earlier this year banned black cars because the president loves white.
Loves white? On cars?
Just white, the colour white, so they banned black cars.
But that's...
Yeah.
I mean, look, I kind of guess that the fact that people were using his face as toilet paper maybe meant he wasn't a super great president.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Oh no, it gets worse than that. This isn't some specially designed printed toilet roll that they're using.
Yeah, no, I know. I assume this is people literally just using newspaper.
Yep.
With his face on.
Yep. And so police and landfill workers have been ordered to look for evidence of this unusual offence and issue warnings that such behaviour could have serious consequences.
Look, what the how? There could be some, like, special police division. CSI Turkmenistan.
Is that where David Crusoe went?
No matter on this picture of the president. I've got to trace it back to the source.
Is that where David Crusoe went? CSI Turkmenistan.
Yes. I can imagine just, like, tearing off sunglasses and go, well, I guess my career's really down the toilet. Yeah! Bow! Bow! I want the show now.
So do I. See, the article actually goes on to explain a couple of things, right? It all started at the end of last year when several children in the northern city of Dashaguz were detained and tried for damaging portraits of the president. In one case, the students at the city's school number 45 trampled on a photo of the president, and in another, children at another school used a pen to draw a mustache and then and beard on a portrait. The portrait obviously being a news article or something like that with a picture of the president, not an actual portrait.
Also, I would like to point out, Goebbels has quite a doughy-looking face.
Yeah.
I think if anything, he should have a beard.
Do you know who he reminds me of? He looks like the Turkmenistan version of Fred Flintstone to me.
No, I can kind of see that.
It's the hairstyle and the... I mean, his hairstyle just looks fake.
Probably is. I think a man who would prosecute people for wiping their bums with pictures of him would also possibly be vain enough to buy a wig.
Yep.
There are police officers who inspect both public and household toilets. CSI Turkmenistan is real!
Yes. Yes, it is. Do you know the disturbing thing about this, Andrew?
Is it literally everything about this story?
Oh no, the disturbing thing about this is it's only a matter of time before America goes the same way. Think about it.
Oh. But would you even want to wipe your bum with a picture of Trump?
No, but Trump might want you to do that. There are those allegations.
I just assume that every single photo of Donald Trump is automatically somehow incredibly greasy.
Sorry, I was just imagining a guy with just pictures of Donald Trump, and he's just got a tub of lard, and he's just taking it out and smearing it over the picture before handing it out to people.
But see, that's the thing. That would be almost all right. But no one knows where the grease comes from.
This is true.
Just you print the picture out, and just somehow the grease is already there.
See, technically, that's a miracle as well, just like those statues of Jesus that cry blood.
Which, incidentally, is what happens when you show a picture of Donald Trump to a statue of Jesus.
Grease versus blood, which one is more powerful?
I feel like I'm not qualified enough in science to answer that.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure that out and I thought, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I can't science this one. Anyway, we are...
It's okay, if once CSI Turkmenistan gets cancelled after one season, that's what we'll get David Caruso on.
Yes. We've got a
CSI Blood Grease. Which actually sounds more like a 90s comic.
Yes, it does. Shall we do the book?
Let's do the book. So, I have been reading The Secret Loves of Geeks, which is edited by Hope Nicholson and with a foreword by Chris Robertson. So, this is an anthology collection. It's a sequel to The Secret Loves of Geek Girls.
Okay.
Which I feel like did we maybe cover at some point?
I think we did one about geek dating, which was very, very patronizing.
No, that doesn't sound like this, because this is an anthology.
Mm.
It's stories, comics, and even a poem by a variety of different writers, basically kind of explaining or recounting their trials and tribulations of dating whilst also being a geek.
Okay.
And yeah, that's just... There's some fun stuff, because there is a bunch of different ones. What was one of my favourites? Oh, there was The White Glove Brigade by Christian Brune, a.k.a. Donnie from Orphan Black.
Ooh.
And it's about him kind of encountering puberty whilst at military school, yeah. And it's just utterly filthy. That's the thing, like, a lot of these stories, they do not pull any punches.
Okay. Definitely not for kids, then.
No, no, not for kids. Not for kids. Oh, yeah, Hope Nicholson, who is the editor for this, she also has a story in it called Pros at Cons, which is just basically about all the hooking up that goes on behind the scenes at comic conventions.
There is a lot.
There is. The fact that, like, comic conventions are full of sex and partying makes me very happy to hear.
It's the hidden side of comic conventions that people don't realise.
I mean, it's kind of the hidden side I always assumed happened, and I'm glad for the confirmation.
I could have told you that.
Yeah, but not for, like, the boring normies. I mean, for, like, all the creators.
Yeah.
Who just, you know, finish up for the day and then get their freak on.
Yes.
Yeah, I think my favourite one was one of the comics called The Horror, The Horror, which had art by Michael Walsh and Jordi Belair, and was written by freaking Margaret Atwood.
What? Margaret Atwood wrote it?
Yep, she did. And it's basically about her growing up in the 1950s and falling in love, not with a guy, but with horror. I just think that there's just a bit like her reading a bedtime story to the children. And, like, and then Cinderella married the prince and doves pecked out the eyes of the wicked sisters. The end. And then cuts to her singing like, "Hush, little children, don't you cry. Mama's gonna bring you a pecked out eye."
Wow. Or
just two very terrified looking children kind of pull the covers up over their heads.
Wow. Ways to amaze and disturb your children, number one.
Yeah, it's just, it's a lot of fun. And then, like, you see her just writing down all these, like, crazy horror stories. And then just cuts to her and her boyfriend with him saying, "How's everything?" "Oh, you know, babysitting, school, the usual."
See, the more you explain this, the more it sounds like a very disturbed character in, you know, in a slasher movie or something like that.
Oh, yeah, I think that's very deliberate. Yeah, it's a nice book. It's a fun mix of people, you know, from all kind of walks in life. You've got, you know, all very different kinds of, you know, heterosexual and homosexual relationships.
Yeah.
And also some that are more about falling in love kind of with being a geek itself.
See, this
and just how a lot of these relationships kind of shape who you are as a person.
See, this sounds quite interesting. And we've had this book for a while as well, and we both forgot that we had it.
Yeah, we did.
But this does actually sound like an enjoyable read, especially if you are a geek, or an old school geek, I should say. Because right now, I'd say with the whole geek culture thing being a cool thing, you know, with superhero movies being as big as they are, the trials and tribulations of being a geek from when I was a kid don't really exist anymore, do they?
I mean, I think that's kind of the point of the book. It's showing that, like, everyone has had very different experiences with geekdom.
And personally, I'm happy about the way things are now. I think it's a great thing.
Oh yeah, definitely. Like, there's going to be a second Ant-Man movie, Rob.
Yeah.
That's the age we live in now.
I know.
Pretty great.
I mean, when I was growing up, we couldn't even envision a Captain America movie. And then the 90s happened. And after that, we didn't want to envision a Captain America movie.
Just even the idea that, like, not only would we get a Captain America movie.
Yeah.
But we would get a Captain America movie, which also combines with a bunch of different Marvel movies to make an Avengers movie and then, like, a whole universe of movies.
Yeah. And then there's Deadpool.
Yeah, Deadpool, a comic book movie that's also very aware of the fact that it's a comic book movie.
Yeah. I'm still remembering that sequence with Domino, with the amazing hair and the slow motion action.
I mean, that is basically Domino in a nutshell.
Yeah. This geek book is out then, now, already.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Kind of the two main things are some of the stories, because all of them are quite short, some of them can feel a bit insubstantial.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of those things that would kind of very much, it can depend which ones you connect to, probably based on your life experiences.
All right.
I think there was one which is called The Walter Mercado Effect by Ivan Salazar and Maddie Gonzalez. And that's about kind of growing up as a gay teen in Mexico.
Yeah, it's something that I can't really relate to.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those ones, because there's not that much to it.
Mm.
Where it's like, if you don't share that experience, there's not necessarily much there for you to connect with.
Yeah.
But I think, though, the only one I will full-on name and shame as being absolutely appallingly awful is The 50 Weirdest Things That Happen in Nerdy Relationships by Diana McCallum.
Okay.
And, you know, I flipped it open and I thought, oh, I see what this is. This is going to make some kind of, you know, profound or funny statement by, you know, twisting the genre of the internet listicle on its head.
Okay. But
no, it's not. It's literally like someone just, it's a list of 50 things, and they are a combination of the most asinine. Look, we've mentioned really popular things like The Walking Dead and Doctor Who and Supernatural. Lol, we're so geeky. And also, like, that kind of the awful stereotype of the nerdy shut-in who doesn't like, you know, the normies and their sports balls.
Give us a couple of examples.
Number 29. You only go out to the bar because they're having a trivia night.
What?
31. Neither of you knows when the local sports team are doing sporty things in the city and constantly get stuck in sport traffic. 32. You both know when a con is happening and laugh at the non-nerds when they're stuck in con traffic.
See, I know that's a horrible, horrible stereotype, but...
Number 50. After a fight, you ask each other if you can Control-Alt-Delete because you'd like to restart.
Nobody in their right mind who is sane and isn't a closet psychopath in any way, shape or form ever, ever asks that.
Yeah, no, they don't. It's just, quite frankly, that is the article I kind of expected.
Yeah.
Because I thought this book was a surprise because I was not excited going into it. It's like, the cover is like, it's a guy, and he's wearing like a purple suit, and the fun, ironic Sherlock Holmes hat. The girl is dressed up in her Harry Potter cosplay. They're all surrounded by the internet cats. Like, there's a Nyan cat, and one with a keyboard, and one's got its head in some toast. And, oh, it's all so wacky and geeky. And those are the kind of awful, awful, terrible people that I feel like this list is aimed at.
See, I thought the book was going to be like that list.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I was really, really frightened for.
Mm. But it turned out most of the book is better than that.
Yeah, most of it.
But still, that list has to be there.
The vacation involves taking the same week off work to play the new Mass Effect.
Sorry, what was that?
17. You have someone to support you emotionally over the loss of the most recent doctor. 11. Choosing to get married feels like the biggest decision you'll ever make until you have to decide which nerdy theme you want for your wedding. Will it be Hogwarts or Hobbiton?
Sorry, they actually use the word nerdy theme?
Yep.
Which kind of proves this wasn't written by anybody who was a geek or a nerd, because if it was, they'd probably just say theme.
Or possibly they might realise that lots of nerds are not solely defined by their nerdery and actually probably want just a night of wedding that is nice.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the Big Bang Theory of articles.
Oh, yeah. That.
Like, where it is clearly written by someone who has never met or talked to a geek.
Yep. Oh, we're physicists and we have to make all these jokes about geek culture because we're geeks. And, oh, look at us, we're geeks. Geeks, goddammit, look, I'm wearing a t-shirt that says geek.
And also by geek culture, you mean incredibly popular TV shows and movies that everyone has heard of.
Yeah, and not incredibly obscure stuff that is actually good.
It's not even that it's not good, it's like just the most basic level of pop culture awareness.
Do you know what one of my biggest gripes about the Big Bang Theory?
Is it the fact that it's terrible? Because that's my biggest gripe.
Well, aside from the fact that it's awful, because it is. One of my biggest gripes was the fact that with other comics that aren't Marvel or DC, there's no actual acknowledgement that they exist.
Oh yeah, no, they do not exist in the Big Bang Theory universe.
You know, so things like the Savage Dragon, things like was there a Hellboy reference? I think there was one Hellboy reference in, like, however many seasons of the Big Bang Theory. There's no Savage Dragon, there's no Tank Girl, there's... Hell, there's not even Calvin and Hobbes.
Yeah, but that would require, like, a single writer on the Big Bang Theory who knows what a comics is.
oh, comics is this thing that, you know, that all the nerds read, isn't it?
Hey, so we're going to write this scene set inside a comic shop. Do you think one of us should actually, like, go to a comic shop and maybe talk to some people there so we can get an authentic feel for it? Nah, that's for nerds, innit? What if the owner can't talk to women? Get it? Because he's such a massive nerd. That's a good joke, isn't it?
Mm. It's such a fantastic joke.
And also, what if the actual joke itself is just him saying, why, I can't talk to women because I'm such a massive nerd?
Do you know what the biggest thing about that, though, about that character, right? Early in the actual series, I think it was the first couple of seasons, nothing wrong with him. He was a business owner. He went to art school. He was good at drawing. And he had no problem talking to men or women. And then all of a sudden, overnight, suddenly he's this recluse who actually is depressed all the time and can't get a relationship.
I feel like what happened with the Big Bang Theory is after, like, the first two seasons, they realised, oh, no, wait, writing likeable and well-rounded characters is hard.
Yeah.
What if Sheldon just didn't know how to be a person and yelled bazinga a lot?
Because that's literally what happened.
Yep.
Anyway, leaving the Big Bang Theory to one side, we are at the end of the show. So we're going to leave you.
God, I wish Big Bang Theory was at the end of the show.
I think it's on its last legs. The audience ratings have been dropping.
But it still won't die.
Because of Ready Player One, I keep telling everybody, Ready Player One is to blame for a lot of things.
Bloody Ready Player One.
Yeah, it made a lot of money. And because it made a lot of money, people are going to look at Big Bang Theory and go, oh yeah, geek stuff is still popular, let's keep this going.
I'm tired and angry now. The show is over. Go home, everyone. We're done.
Graham will be back next time. But until then, I have been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And we will see you all later. Don't watch The Big Bang Theory.
Thanks for listening. And no, seriously, don't watch The Big Bang Theory. It's so very bad.